Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Today's guest is novelist Ace Atkins. An award-winning New York Times best-selling author, Ace Atkins started his writing career as a crime beat reporter in Florida. Don't Let the Devil Ride is his 30th novel. His previous novels include 11 books in the Quinn Coulson series and multiple true crime novels based on infamous crooks and killers. In 2010, Ace was chosen by Robert B. Parker's family to continue the iconic Spencer series, adding 10 novels to the franchise. He lives in Oxford, Mississippi with his family. Ace, I want to thank you so much for doing this. We followed each other for a long time. We have a lot of great friends in common, so this is a real pleasure. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's so nice to finally be able to sit down and talk about these movies we've been prepping for several weeks. Yeah. And so many of these films I haven't checked in with for quite some time, even decades. So it's been, it's been a pleasure to get back to the Soviet paranoia that shaped my life.
Yeah, that we grew up in, because I was born in 81. And even as a kid, I remember, Ruskies and Nikita and all of those movies that came out then. And so, Red Dawn, when I saw it, scared the hell out of me.
You mentioned Ruskies because that's a film that's been on my list and I've never seen it. So I haven't seen it. So I'll have to have that on there. But yeah, the Good Russian is always something I think we were all hoping for at that time.
Yes. Yeah, there were all of those films around that time for sure. And obviously you're an author, over 30 books. You were writing some of the Parker novels and you have a new one coming out. So what have you been working on?
I have a new book that's coming out from William Morrow in the summer, in June, called Don't Let the Devil Ride. And it's a book that's set here in nearby Memphis. It's a crime novel, involves an older private investigator, involves a woman whose life has been completely upended in a very Hitchcockian type story. And then, of course, stealing a bit from Hitchcock as well, as this leads to international intrigue and spies, missing documents and all kinds of fun stuff. And so cinema for me has been just a huge role in influencing the kind of books that I wanted to write.
Yeah, I was doing some reading about your background, and I read in an interview you said originally you wanted to go to film school.
I did. They wouldn't accept me.
Oh, no.
Back in the 80s, I really wanted to get into USC film school, and I got very close to getting to USC, and I was hoping that was going to work out. And then, but I did end up, I was not at USC, but at Auburn University. They had a wonderful, wonderful professor who taught film and TV writing named George Pleskidas. And I ended up studying film and TV anyway, just down south, not in California.
Yeah, exactly. And now, you can do so much reading. There's so many amazing books. It's like you can supplement and create your own education as you go. And I know we have mutual friends. You are really good friends with William Boyle and Megan Abbott, who've been on my podcast a bunch. And during the pandemic, I was in a pandemic movie club. It was started by my good friend, Jordan Harper, and it had Blake Howard, Travis Woods, and Judd Ayers was also in it. And so I was the sole girl. And I remember talking to Megan Abbott about that because she loved her pandemic movie club with you guys. So talk to me about that club.
Well, I mean, I think it was really funny for people like us. I don't know how hard the shutdown was for a lot of people, because when you talk about, okay, you can't go out, you can't do anything, but you're going to have to watch movies, you're going to have to read books. I think for us, we maybe were able to adjust a little bit better. And certainly that was the case with my close friends when we were talking about movies during the pandemic. There was always new eras to explore. There were always new stars, new tangents. Nothing was too obscure. I can't even remember some of the paths that we went down. They were so arcane. But it ended up becoming a real kind of source of fun for us. And then we would end up at the end of the week, we would get on like this and talk about what we'd seen. And we'd talk about what we needed, to, you know, we wanted to see. So it really, thinking back in that time was such a strange time, but it really kept us going with something to look forward to every week.
Yeah, it was a good way to connect and kind of deepen some of the friendships with people who don't live in your area anyway. And so it was a nice excuse to sort of unite, because you'd meet up to talk about movies. But the great thing about talking about any kind of art form is it brings you down so many avenues and you wind up talking about life. And it's
I obviously miss the pandemic.
No,
I do miss the movie club. That was always something, you know, every weekend we knew we were going to be checking in, and we knew that we needed to do our homework and we needed to come up with some good anecdotes about the films we'd watched. And it was I hate to say it, but it was actually an enjoyable time during a very tough period.
Yes. Now, was it specifically crime focused?
I honestly, Jen, there was so much work during that time. It wasn't just crime focused. I mean, we watched all kinds of crazy stuff.
Oh, nice.
I remember at one point our friend Jimmy Kajolis had recommended, which I cannot think of right now, a Japanese horror vampire film.
Wow.
I think we had watched a lot of pre-code films, which we all just absolutely love. Mm-hmm. Looking for some really obscure stuff. I think we'd watch some Westerns. So we were pretty much all over the place.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was the one that introduced the group to Westerns, because we kind of stuck with crime, but I sort of took it down some other avenues, like, nope, we're going to watch Man of the West this week, you guys. So that was a lot of fun.
Gary Cooper.
Yeah, love that movie. Yeah. Yes. Well, we were trying to come up with a good topic for this episode, and you brought up spy movies and 80s, because this was, you told me, a good era where you were at the movie theater a lot. I was at the video store all the time as a kid. And then in the 90s, I lived at the theater too, but I was also catching up on all of these movies. So it was a really good excuse to kind of go back and watch some of these again. Some of them are my favorites. I know you hadn't watched a couple of these in a while, but why don't you talk to me about the 80s and about this Cold War paranoia and what that was like as a film fan?
Well, and it's so fun to finally be able to talk to someone who's also watched these films and kind of bring them back out to the light. And I do miss that, you know, I'm sure, you know, you talk about it all the time, that video store connection that was almost like going to film school, that you could go in and you could see the entire section. You could catch up with films that you missed if you were younger. I mean, I remember, you know, really talking about spy films, getting back into, for some reason, during the mid to late 80s, and I think it had something to do with rights issues, there was a tremendous amount of spy stuff that was out on the UHF channels. So there were just really obscure spy films from 67, 68 that I would just be watching, that would come in on the Saturday or the Sunday or late night movie, and I would follow those movies. And I also was a huge James Bond fan. I loved
Bond, me too.
Especially the original films as well. Just I don't think really obsession probably even covers what my love of those films. And then to find out there were these side spoof movies, and I got into all that kind of stuff. So in the 80s, though, it just was, I think, all around, you know, your life. It was just expected. And now I'm working on, I've even taken a deeper dive. The new book that's coming out in June is partially a spy book. But the new book that I'm working on right now for 2025 is all a spy book, and it's all about this period. And so this has allowed me to not only check in with some of these films as far as what the movies are about, but just the era as far as the clothing. And, you know, I mean, we talked about this a little bit with No Way Out, but just a lot of furs, a lot of big shoulder pads, a lot of makeup, and I suspect a lot of cocaine on the set. There's a lot of rapid fire dialogue. I think these films, I think with the exception of Falcon and the Snowman, which honestly I had only recently seen, I saw all of them in the theater. And so these were big films. These were films that were, you know, a Target kind of came and went. I remember when it came out, but it still was a major release. And I was one of those kids that had to see everything that came out. But I mean, you think about this period, you know, everything from Jumpin' Jack Flash to, you know, looking like the Val Kilmer movie that's the
Top
comedy.
Secret.
Or Top Secret, Real Genius too, because Real Genius
talks about
the Star Wars spy program, and then you get into things like Rocky IV and Spies.
Oh my
like
gosh!
Us, you know, and you know, so it was a real, you know, and then going back now to this project that I'm working on is not only looking at film but also looking at newspapers of the time and old magazines, and what it just was all in our collective consciousness. The idea of KGB agents living among us, the fact that the arms race that was going on, Reagan's Star Wars program, the idea that you could zap somebody from outer space with a laser, all of these kind of things. With War Games, which to me, I think maybe the best of all of these films. I think it's just a masterpiece. And I've watched that recently, and that has held up extremely well. But yeah, no, I saw these movies in the theaters. This is just what people were talking about. This is what our lives were like. This is, you know, everything back to, you know, severe paranoia, you know, with all these kind of films. You just felt like, you know, there was this, not, I won't say impending doom, but there was this competitiveness with the Russians that we were always feeling.
Yeah, and it was the tail end of the Cold War for sure. And I'm glad you brought up James Bond, because I grew up with an older brother. He was my movie buddy. And so, you know, we watched all the Bond movies, all the Rocky movies. And I do remember, you know, this era was the Roger Moore. He was my first James Bond. I've done an episode on the Roger Moore era and the Pierce Brosnan era. And we're going to do Daniel Craig later this season. But yes, you know, I think spies were back in vogue again. They were back at the end of the 60s, and then we kind of took a break in the 70s a little bit. But in the 80s, we were right back at it. I think Hollywood was trying to make these bigger movies, and they were going for extreme emotions to try to get people back in the theater, because attendance had started to lull a little bit in the late 70s. So I think this was a good way to do that, like, you know, dial in on an emotion and scare the hell out of you, or comment on what's going on. And that's what these movies did. But they, you know, turned the volume up to 11, essentially.
And I think there was also a period, too, in the 70s, and I think certainly with the James Bond films, where they didn't want to head on address the conflict of the superpowers. And you go back and you look at those Bond films, especially in the Moore era, and actually even going back to the Connery era as well, is that the Russians really aren't the main bad guys. They are somebody that eventually Bond has to work with in order to take on this this crazy, you know, the villain that is going to be set on world domination. And I think even in the era of Octopussy and From a View to a Kill, all that kind of stuff, never was specifically the Russians. It may have been an entry point. It may have been something they thought was Russian connected, but it was almost like part of the Bond formula is never to get too in deep with that the Russians are strictly the bad guys.
Yes, it's more escapist for sure. It's just more of the lore. Yes. But you brought up Target. I think that was the one that was the newest to me for sure. I saw it a few years ago. I think it was playing on one of the streaming services and I just stumbled on it. And I was surprised. I might have seen it as a kid, but it wasn't ringing a bell. Arthur Penn, you know, working again with Gene Hackman. Night Moves, of course, is a favorite. I know Megan loves that movie too. I think this one with Matt Dillon was a good discovery. I was glad to revisit it. I think I liked it a little bit better this time. It's still not my favorite, but it's really compelling. I mean, it just kind of grabs you and goes. He is somebody who is playing just, you think, is an ordinary Joe, and his wife goes overseas on a business trip and is taken. And then you find out, of course, he was a CIA guy, and he's not Liam Neeson. He doesn't, but he does have some special sets of skills that he pulls out of his hat, and he has a little bit of an issue with Matt Dillon, but they work together, father and son. So there's a lot going on with this one. Talk to me about Target. You think you saw that one at the theater too?
I did see that. And I remember it, you know, so funny, your memories of what I really recall about it is I remember as far as the cinematography of it stuck in my mind as being a fairly gloomy looking film.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting choice, the way that it was shot, whether because that was just the time frame or whatever, but it starts off in Texas and it's a very working class town outside Dallas. And there's a lot of very gritty, almost kind of like 1970s, very grounded shots. And I think the same way that they shoot Europe as well, it doesn't seem to feel like an overly exotic place. And maybe the sets are somewhat clean, but as far as exterior shots are very dark. But I do remember seeing it film. I don't remember it making a huge impact on me. I remember just thinking, okay, this is a interesting film and spy movie and that kind of thing. But then I went back to revisit it just because of the, not only because of the time period, but also Arthur Penn, Gene Hackman. And I thought there's going to be something a little bit more to this film. And, you know, Hackman is just phenomenal. And
one of my favorites.
Always so much, so attracted to this kind of story. This had to have landed on his desk, and to play a guy that was a CIA agent that's gone undercover and, you know, change his whole life and become an average Joe. And I saw these parallels, and I'm sure, Jen, you can come up with examples before this, but in some ways it reminded me a little bit of watching like Pixar's The Incredibles, where you had a family
that was
completely dull and boring, or something like True Lies. But it reminded me kind of a precursor of that, because Matt Dillon's disdain for his father is he can't drive. He doesn't know how to get on an air. Has he ever been on an airplane before? He's so unsophisticated and boring. I thought it was a terrific entry point and a great way for those characters to play off each other.
Yeah, like along his goodnight situation where...
Absolutely.
She's just someone in the suburbs and then she's not. But I think that's a good point about Hackman. He likes to play someone with a little bit of mystery, or someone you might assume one thing about, but there's more to the surface. These qualities that come out. I think Hackman is one of our great actors, but he makes it look so easy. He reminds me of Donald Sutherland a little bit, or Bruce Dern. They just kind of slide into these roles. It isn't very showy. We're going to talk about Sean Penn, who I love, but he shows you acting, and it's a little bit different. He's tremendous. But Hackman kind of undersells or underplays, or he just sort of puts it on almost like a skin. And this really does fit him well. I think Matt Dillon, this was a great era for Matt Dillon. I just talked about Rumblefish and The Outsiders the other night, but then eventually in the late 80s, he was in like Drugstore Cowboy and really coming into his own. So I can imagine how exciting it would have been for him to work opposite Gene Hackman, for sure.
And I think the promo material, I think that was the selling point. I think for me as a kid is, of course, being, 14, 15 years old at this time period is you're thinking about, it's a Matt Dillon movie. I'm going to go see Matt Dillon. It's the guy from The Outsiders or Tex I like that guy. I'm going to go see. And so it had a kind of a dual sales point for younger and older generations. And for me, that was the thing that got me into the theater. But I could agree more on Hackman. He is one of our all-time. I mean, everything that he's in, he elevates. And, we'll talk about No Way Out later. But, it's like the old adage of never let them catch you acting, and you never catch him acting, and you watch him in really extreme situations with actors who perhaps are very heightened and very over the top and whatever. And you never see him ever break that level that he's in. He never ups the ante. Ups the ante in a over the top way. He has such a calmness and a charisma about it. I don't think there's ever a point ever watching Gene Hackman that you doubt the moment that he's in. He's there.
Yesterday I recorded an episode on John Cusack from like 89 through the Being John Malkovich era. And in an interview when I was doing research, he was talking about making the movie shortly after that called Identity. And he said how it's very different because he's playing a thriller, and he said, you're playing silences. And I liked that kind of analysis of it, because thinking about Gene Hackman, that's what he does so well. I mean, the conversation, moves. And then in this too, he is playing the quiet, or you're kind of watching him and he knows what he's doing. doing, and he's not telling his son everything. And then we realize he wants to protect his feelings, and also just he is maybe sizing up some of his old CIA buddies, but he's playing those silences so well. Yeah.
It's definitely part of that, the wonderful Hemingway rule of the iceberg. And that's what I feel like with Hagman's acting. I feel like there's so much beneath the surface and so much that he knows about this character and so much that he's internalized, I think, about his relationship with maybe these characters who are coming on the screen for only a moment, but you see the recognition in the face and the camaraderie he has, that it seems so warm and so genuine that, again, it is it doesn't seem like film. It seems like you're watching real life.
Yeah. And you brought up something interesting when you were talking about the James Bond movies and how Bond had to work with Russians or foreign parties to, get to the bottom of things. And that's something I loved about Target, is it's showing how he has to work with intelligence operatives in other countries and, how that plays in and, an old lover. And then Matt Dillon learns a whole new side of his dad that he never knew about, which, again, I think going for what you said, also the multi-generational appeal. Yeah.
And I think people were very, going back and revisiting the true stories of this time period, of what was happening and what was in the news with double agents and people selling out their own countries. I think there was such a great bit of kind of disdain and world weariness towards espionage. It wasn't a jingoistic era for America. I think we have thought the whole system was dirty. And I think that at some point we really hoped, like we have in these films, is that there is a counter sentiment among the Soviets, that the Soviets are just as tired of these games, so just as tired of this, the lies being perpetuated. And I think that's the commonality in the mid-80s spy film, is that, yay, America, we're winning on this. It's just a very kind of John le Carré, very jaundiced eye towards mm-hmm. the entire espionage game. And hopefully we find an ally on the other side that again, we, saves us from, world demolition.
Yeah. And talking about double agents and what's going on in other countries, we should probably just slide right into The Falcon and the Snowman. We're recording this on Super Bowl Sunday, and I've told this story a million times, but actually growing up, I'm not a football person. My mom would rent movies every year, and she was always trying to rent, things she knew I would love. And one year she rented Falcon and the Snowman, and I completely fell in love with it. I think it would have been around early 90s for sure, and it was maybe one of my earliest exposures to both Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn, based on a true story, of course. Christopher Boyce and Andrew Dalton Lee, who sold out their country for, I think one of them had, idealistic, kind of misguided reasons. He was working at a defense contracting place and saw some secrets and saw some things involving Gaku and a removal of, I think it was like the prime minister of Australia, something that rubbed him the wrong way. And he just thought it was wrong. And his conniving, wild, larger than life childhood friend, they were altar boys together, but he took a different path and became a drug dealer. That is Sean Penn, of course. Decides he's going to be the one to bring it into Mexico and sell it to the Russians. And it's a dark film. It's John Schlesinger, and it's a phenomenal picture. I know you aren't quite as in love with it. So your relationship with this movie, did you say you just saw it recently?
I actually watched this maybe it was around 6 months ago, and it was prepping for this new book that I was going to be writing. And again, it's so funny to think about this film. I didn't see it in the theaters, but I remember it being everywhere. Yes. And I was living in suburban Atlanta at the time, and I remember every cinema was showing this film, and the reviews were phenomenal. It's very highly lauded. People absolutely love this film. It was stayed in the theaters for quite some time, unlike Target that kind of came and went, and I just had a vague memory of it. I think it's an uneven picture. And I think that Timothy Hutton is phenomenal. He's so good in the film. And, and Sean Penn, in his own way, is great too. And I think, it was the first time that I remember... I was a kid that probably shouldn't have seen Fast Times when it came out. You know, I was way too young for it. But that was my field of reference for Sean Penn was Fast Times. So I think this was the first film that I have a recollection of saying, oh, wow, Sean Penn's trying to be a serious actor. You know,
he's a grown up.
Mm-hmm. He's grown up. And I think he was obviously very aware of it. So I think this was that film for him that was the breakout of being a character actor and being something. And he is playing a very wide character here, very broad character. Yes. But the character is, you know, he is a drug dealer. He's on cocaine. He's larger than life. He has no moral compass. He's a huckster. He's, you know, he's a scammer. He's all these things that Timothy Hutton's character is not. It seemed to me, going back and watching the film, the one thing that struck me there is it seemed almost like it was filmed at different and an uneven production schedule. It seemed that the film is supposed to be set in 1976. And, you know, you're watching this and it begins very much trying to show you what was happening in 1976 America. And you'll have to remind me of the great character actor who plays Timothy Hutton's father, plays the FBI agent. He was he was Commissioner Gordon in the Tim Burton Batman film. And he's just a wonderful character actor.
Pat
always
Hingle.
Always playing an Irish cop, you know, and he's just perfectly cast here. And he has, you know, 12 kids and Timothy Hutton is one of them. And he calls upon these friends that he has to get his kind of screw up son this job at the defense contracting company. But as the film goes on, you can tell either they ran out of money or whatever happened. So then it's very much set, you know, in 1984, you know, America. So it kind of jumps a decade as far as aesthetically what it looks like. I don't know if that's as evident, you know, maybe for me, it's really clear that, you know, of you know, being part of those two periods. So that was a bit jarring to me. But again, I did love the premise. You know, certainly Sean Penn was larger than life, but you can't stop watching him. I mean, every scene, he's just phenomenal. And it's a much different character than Spicoli. He's a brand new, just wild man. But I enjoyed the film, but I think it was, again, just an odd. I think the only thing that threw me is it seemed very much of the period, very much mid-80s to me, perfectly with the defense contractors, with the stolen secrets, with the paranoia of the Soviets, everything was going on. But I wish that the film, Schlesinger early on had made the decision of, all right, let's just update this. This is happening in the 80s. This is not happening in the 70s. And that was probably the biggest problem for me.
Yeah, I think even some of the technology does look pretty 80s. And also, you have the post-Vietnam era of what did we do over there. I think that character I wanted to know more about. Some of the supporting players were so good and so interesting, and it made me want to read the book, which I haven't done. I'm from Minnesota originally, and I have some law enforcement people in my family, and I remember I think it was Boyce. I can't remember which one was at one of our prisons. And one of them saw him and was telling me the story of all of that. And so it was part of my childhood. I remember hearing about these individuals. And so I think you also brought up something really good about Sean Penn. This was, you know, he has admitted that Robert De Niro was his idol, and he kind of played De Niro a little bit early on. You can kind of see that in some of his choices, his physicality a little bit. But it is him kind of coming into his own and figuring out what he can do. I think Racing with the Moon had come out maybe a year before. So he was.
It seems to me that it was like kind of maybe even simultaneously. And again, so I saw that in the theater with Elizabeth McGovern. And that was just phenomenal. But it was kind of the year of Sean Penn.
Yeah.
And Mary's Madonna. I mean, it all like 1985.
I know, it was such a whirlwind era for him, for sure. And, you know, and I think Hutton doesn't get enough credit for just how great he was in this period. He wasn't as showy either. I think Ordinary People is just a masterpiece. It was actually the first film I remember watching in my very first college level film class. Our professor showed it and he like paused it every 5 seconds to bring up something new about framing or whatever. So he kind of ruined it, the first experience. But when I watched it whole, you really get a sense of what Timothy Hutton did in that film and why he received the Oscar. And then this coming right after it, he is so good. He is so contemplative. He's kind of that Gene Hackman playing the quiet mode of acting. And so you kind of have, two opposite poles here, but you need that. If you have two Sean Penns you're watching in a movie, it's going to be overwhelming. Yeah.
And I agree with you. And he's so phenomenal. Again, was such a huge part of my film experience being, for me, being a kid of the 80s and getting to, get down to the mall. And the first thing you do is find out what's showing at the movie theater. Timothy Hutton was all over the place. Another film that I thought he was fantastic in and gets kind of overlooked as a film called Turk 182. And I don't know if you know that.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And he is so fantastic in that. And again, playing the same type of conflicted character, yes, of a person who thinks they're beginning off doing something very right and has a very much of an issue, and then completely caught up in the machine and the dirtiness. And by the end of this film, he's just completely wrung out. I think he is just terrific in the movie. And again, I agree, that kind of Hackman, that old school way of acting, which is not to act at all, but just to be very present. And the other one who I think is very, who is terrific in it, and I just wish, I don't know if there were more scenes that were cut, is Laurie Singer.
Again,
was just such a huge movie star in the mid 80s,
Footloose.
But I feel like that was maybe another big issue with this problem, is she doesn't really have anything to do.
No.
The script just, I couldn't really figure out. She's just, eye candy. She's part there and she did, but she's not a part of the film. She doesn't have I would have loved to have seen more of that in the movie.
Yeah, I think some of these people that were in their periphery, what did they know and how did they react? And I think she's kind of just there to worry about Hutton and not know what's going on and kind of, pull on our emotions a little bit. So, yeah, I agree with you there. I made the guys in my Pandemic Movie Club watch this because I don't think any of them had seen it. Maybe Blake Howard had, but that was it. Or maybe Jed. I can't remember which. And by the end, I can't remember which one kind of came back to me as like, I feel like I went through a marathon because of the amount of emotion. It starts out one way and it's a little bit jovial and a little crazy at the beginning because of Penn. And then by the end of it, you're just so drained. Yeah.
And the Hutton's character is which one?
He's recall. Boyd.
And I just recently did an interview with a former FBI agent who was working in the mid 80s. And he said that Boyd was one of the examples when he would go out and give talks to people that worked in high clearance businesses, to, defense contractors.
Oh, the Christopher Boyd.
Tell the story of him, as far as, I think his quote is, if you don't stand for something, you don't stand for anything. And I think that was his big quote. And he was used as a prime example of somebody who absolutely was a huge traitor to this country and ended up spending, I think he's maybe still in prison, I'm not sure that the end story. I know that he was.
I think he got out, but it took a long time. Yeah.
It was something like a 30 to 40 year sentence, but it was still considered one of the great stains against this country, and one of the greatest traitors. And I don't know if that would resonate the same today as it did in the 80s, but selling out the country.
Oh my God.
Also selling out the country. I think that now we have perhaps people that would laud people that sell us out to the Russians.
Like the Snowdens.
Right. The people that maybe the Russians aren't so bad, but I think it's really important to revisit these films because, somebody like Vladimir Putin is certainly created as a very mid 80s type of evil character.
Yeah.
And I think we have to be very much reminded that the KGB and KGB spawn or ex-KGB agents will do anything through misinformation to destroy this country. So I find it very topical at this time.
They are very timely. And our next movies deal directly with the KGB comedically and then in a thriller mode. But yes, Jumpin' Jack Flash is a childhood favorite. I'm running a podcast series right now with my friend Blake, Midnight Run Through. And in it, I frequently will tell guests that the three movies I watched the most as a child were Beverly Hills Cop, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Midnight Run. And I have no idea why my vocab, I don't like curse like a trucker, essentially. But Jumpin' Jack Flash was a favorite. My grandma loved Whoopi Goldberg. And so when I watch it to this day, like some of the really funny moments, I can almost hear her laughing, which I love so much. But yes, in the movie, you have Whoopi Goldberg, and this was her first big thing. And it was Penny Marshall, her first film. And so it's great on that level. But she is playing a bank employee who's good on her computer. And she chats with foreign people all the time, trading recipes and love advice. And then all of a sudden, someone pops into her mainframe who is a spy who's trapped and needs to get an exit contact. And so she finds herself getting in over her head, and the KGB is involved. My friend Rob Belushi's dad, Jim Belushi, is in the movie. He's a villain. So yeah, it's a blast. I love this film. But I'm curious, this is one you remembered probably the least, I think you said.
You know, I saw the film again. I was one of those kids, Gen X kids, that I had to see every movie that was out. You know, mm-hmm. I did see almost everything in the theater. I was there. And in 1986, I may remember this faulty. I think it was a big summer release for 86, maybe July, August, and going to the theater and watching it. And okay, you know, and I knew, yeah. but as a kid, that was my reaction, 15 years old. And, but what struck me about all these films, this was the one that you brought in, and it was the one I thought that I would probably like the least and ended up really liking it.
Yes.
And I thought it was so much fun and so much better than I remembered and has held up really well. And I guess Whoopi Goldberg had done Color Purple before this, but this was kind
of this was first, her solo. Yep.
This was her first, you know, but I remember her as Whoopi Goldberg from the HBO comedy specials.
Yes.
So I think that she had done some big HBO, and back at that time, back in the old days, you know, when you had a big stand-up special on HBO, that was quite a big deal. That was a huge deal. Everyone knew you. So this was the first time to see Whoopi Goldberg in a starring vehicle doing.
Yes, comedy. She's carrying it. Yep.
That was it. But it really was so much fun. And, you know, I mean, what a cast. I mean, you know, it was like, it just as side characters. And I
all
had
all of them, Michael McKean, Tracy Ullman, like
Phil
my
Hartman.
Gosh.
Phil Hartman is just one of the guys. And I
John Lovitz.
John Lovitz. And I want to say this was before or simultaneously that Saturday Night Live got rebooted when Lorne Michaels took back over. And I think this was maybe before even anyone knew who Lovitz and Hartman were. Carol Kane. I mean, it's just incredible. You know, Gary Marshall shows up as a cop. And
Annie Potts.
Annie Potts. It's just like, and just little roles, just little, just kind of walk-on roles. But I think that is such a credit to Penny Marshall as being such a great director. And that some of this, from my recollection, it's funny how your memory, you know, plays with you, you know, 40 years down the road, is I remember this as being a zany, over-the-top, wild kind of thing. But she really got these people very grounded.
Really,
there is such a sardonic edge to the comedy. The other thing that struck me when I was watching the credits is I think there were like 5 to 6 writers on this thing.
Yes, so many.
I thought, that's not good. And you could see, if you look at this whole film, it's kind of a craziness as far as what is it about and where they're playing or whatever. But I would kind of think if we did a little bit deeper digging, I think that Penny Marshall was doing a lot of kind of sketching on the set. It seemed
to
have her fingerprints all over it. But I thought it was so much fun. I thought Whoopi Goldberg was terrific. I thought it was just the great, you know, it's really a Hitchcock story. And, you know, she's caught up in this web of crazy intrigue, and she's just this bank clerk. It's so funny to watch our views of, and this was a huge movie of pop culture, our views of what computers were and what they could do. And nobody, I think, really figured it out. And sometimes I think that there was a realism to what computers were doing at this time, but also some misunderstanding of how far of what we could learn from computers. So there's some moments that were kind of laughable that, you know, I think that maybe even more so in No Way Out of what computers could do. But as far as just an entertaining film, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love by the end, it's Jonathan Pryce, to think of another actor that you maybe don't expect is on the other end of all of these messages, sort of early chat messages. But I remember
seeing the film. Oh, no, I'm so sorry. But like when he stepped out, and I was trying to think where he would have been just in the ether during that period, because
Something Wicked This Way Comes, I think he had done.
I remember the audience reacting like, oh, I know that guy. I like that.
Oh, nice.
But, you know, you kind of expected not just I mean, that's kind of what the story believed. You know, you believe the whole time that he was just a British spy, and you know, weren't sure what to expect. Is this guy going to be overly handsome or debonair? Yeah. Or, you know, and I think that probably, I'm going to guess at one time in the script, it was probably somebody she knew, and then it's going to come back around. That's really a guy in her office, and you know, that kind of stuff. But I thought it landed as exactly of who we thought Jack was going to be.
Yeah.
And I remember the audience reacting and having a feeling like, wow, that's awesome. That's exactly who we expect to show up. And it was just perfectly cast.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And it's one, I think, if you haven't seen this movie in a while, or you haven't seen it, that crime writers and film buffs especially would love, because you're dealing with a character, you see her apartment, she loves pulp novels, she has film posters everywhere, she watches old movies, she gets caught up in stories. You were bringing up the Hitchcock of it all. And I think it is so true, like, you know, as a person who sees these things as escape, all of a sudden, wait, I'm in one of these stories. And I think that she plays that very well. She doesn't get too carried away. I think sometimes in this era, some of these, like you said, the HBO comedians like Robin Williams, who I love too, Billy Crystal, sometimes they let their personality drive the performance, and it takes you out of it a little bit. But Whoopi really does stay in it. There are some moments where, like, she goes undercover and she's lip singing and it's over the top a little bit, and there are those Whoopi-ish kind of moments, but overall I think, you know, they do keep you really rooted in what this world is.
I would imagine there were probably some demands from the producers at this point.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We must do this. That we must have this. And I, again, credit to Penny Marshall, as she kept those bits to a minimum, knowing that they really could get, you know, too much. And it was funny, when I was watching this film earlier this week, I actually unfortunately had COVID, which I was not really excited about.
But I'm sorry.
So there was a point where I wasn't sure if I was hallucinating, and Whoopi Goldberg comes on. I was like, does she actually have a large toothbrush in this as a prop?
Yes, she does.
Or is this something that I misremember? If I had some kind of reaction to my medication, but there is a large toothbrush that plays a big part. But I kept on trying during the film to see the Easter eggs. And of course, there's some very obvious stuff, a movie poster for Maltese Falcon and Casablanca. Yeah. And I kept on trying to freeze frame on some of the books she was reading. And also in all these films, I remember even going back to Target, there's a part where Gene Hackman's asleep in bed and he's reading an espionage novel by Lynn Dighton, who wrote Funeral in Berlin. And I thought that was just a nice little touch. So there's a lot of literary references in these movies as well.
Yes, very cool. And getting back to Gene Hackman with our next movie, No Way Out, which is one I will always watch when it's on streaming. And it's funny, it is ridiculous. It's over the top. It's fast paced. It's twisty. It's a remake of The Big Clock, which is a great film as well. But this is the one, of course, I watch the most. We're going to probably get into spoilers here, so be warned. Though, if you haven't seen this movie, what are you doing? Watch that movie for sure. You have Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman seem to be the big draws. But for me, the more I watch it, the more I am just drawn to Will Patton, who I think is giving one of the great performances. Actually, James Urbaniak, who's a friend, replied, and he's like, I think seeing this in the theater then, thinking this is one of those performances he will always remember. Yeah.
Will Patton is fantastic. And I think of Will Patton a lot more. He does these wonderful audiobooks of one of my favorite all-time writers, James Lee Burke. And he is the voice of James Lee Burke. And it's hard to watch Will Patton where I don't hear that Louisiana accent. But he is just a force of nature in this film. And you talk about watching a character who slowly becomes absolutely unhinged in this. And it's a very subtle character, because there's a lot of details that we learn about him throughout where we and he's not there. It's not a very overt in the script or in his behavior of little details about him. But, you know, you start with the thing of his kind of odd hero worshiping of the Navy officer who's Kevin Costner. And you see his kind of crazy devotion to him. But this kind of dual devotion, it's really a love story.
Love story,
A torn love story that he has between Costner and Hackman and his allegiances. And there's a wonderful part, just a little kind of subtle thing. And it's not a very subtle movie. I mean, there's fist fights in a shopping mall and Amon is in it, and I think that there certainly was some, I'm going to venture to guess, some cocaine on that script. You really read that.
Yeah, and just gratuitous nudity galore with Sean Young.
Just I think that was part, I mean, and I really, but there's a part, I think, where after the murder, and I don't think we're giving anything away, after Sean Young is murdered, which is the whole story, I think it's Hackman that comes into Will Patton's into his home, into his brownstone where he lives in Georgetown, and he comes in and he's putting on his robe, and it's the, you know, he's just killed killed his mistress, and behind them there's a little statue of a guy sitting down with his loyal dog, and it's just like very, and when you watch the frame, the way everything is framed, and the wonderful parts of the language of cinema, which we could talk about forever, being, I think, eroded these days in the days of content and things that aren't really cinema anymore. But it has this little thing of, you see the loyal servant of the dog being the loyal servant of the master. And you see him, you know, Hackman coming in and asking for this huge favor from his chief of staff. But I agree with you. I think Will Patton is tremendous in this film. And his final bit, which we don't have to discuss, is truly
a
great moment in film of seeing a character completely implode. And it's phenomenal. I think he's maybe the star of the whole picture.
Yes, I agree with you. And the filmmaker, Roger Donaldson, is a great filmmaker. I think one he made in 2008 that I don't think got enough credit was The Bank Job. Which did you see?
Realize that I did not even put together that he had directed The Bank Job. So is he British?
He is actually, Australian and New Zealand film director, born in Victoria, Australia. Yeah.
The only connection that I made to him was Marathon Man.
Marathon Man was.
No, I'm Schlesinger. Connected. I'm sorry. That's with Schlesinger. I'm so sorry. Yeah,
he's British.
With Donaldson, I agree. Bank Job is fantastic. Yeah, yeah. Jason Statham's best movie. No offense to The Beekeeper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Donaldson also made like The Bounty. He made 13 Days, World's Fastest Indian. But this was the era of Cocktail, so he made that movie. So he was, you know, he was the hot Hollywood director there for a little bit. But No Way Out has so much going on. I think, Kevin Costner was really doing something daring here. He was playing off of his star power from like Bull Durham. This was around that period, and taking it into a totally different direction by the end of the movie. Hackman is playing a real supporting part in this. I think you go in expecting him to be kind of the heavy, and when I watch it again, you really see that's kind of Will Patton is really the one who's the driving force and is in between these men who are rivals, who are both involved with the Sean Young character. And it's just fascinating. Yeah.
And how much Patton's character hates the Sean Young character and has such disdain for her. And then you kind of put everything together his love for these two men and his devotion for these two men, I think eventually is what just makes him completely unhinged. But I agree. Again, we go back, keep on going to Will Patton on this, is that he does a lot of the heavy emotional lifting in these scenes where characteristically you have Hackman very sedated and as a man who's just committed murder, but very much, I think, true of a guy who's the head of the Department of Defense, trying to keep things on the up and up, trying to keep business as usual, trying to do his job and try to, you know, very rarely his ego allows him to confront himself.
Yeah, 100% for sure. I also love some of the old-fashioned cloak and dagger aspects of this movie, like kind of piecing together the mystery. We know what has transpired. We know like who is responsible for the death, but also some of these things that seem like throwaway moments earlier come back, like an interaction that Costner had taking his girlfriend Sean Young away for the weekend with like the guy who brought the luggage up, essentially the bellhop. that is going to come back and he has to hide from that guy. You brought up the technology. There's sort of this ticking clock aspect of she had taken his photo and he, you know, pulled it open intentionally to spoil it before his photo would get recognized. And a computer is just slowly trying to deduce who's behind this image that people can't make out, which is interesting and kind of over the top. An entire sort of CIA group just sitting there. I think the character of his friend who he's asking favors for is a fascinating. We have a disabled character, heartbreaking. What happens to him? I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but yeah,
it's hard to talk about this movie because it is a movie that's all about spoilers.
Yeah, it
and
is. It's
all, and if you know the final puzzle piece, then
oh my gosh,
you need to even watch it because the final puzzle piece. I watched it with my wife, and she had never seen it. And I was watching it, there are so many little hints. Like when you watch it all together, the final little puzzle piece is exactly as it should be. You see the setup. And at some points I feel like they play their hand a little bit too much. Like it's there. Don't you see it?
Going in.
Oh, sure.
But
this was a film that you watched a lot. And I have to say, being a teenage boy at this time, of course, you would always watch No Way Out when it was on because the limo scene.
Yeah.
You know, the limo scene. The limo scene was very famous at the time. But it was interesting, the reaction for that final twist, which is everything about the movie, and is so much fun and makes so much sense, and it really, I think, elevates the whole picture when you go back and you watch it. It just adds so much to everything you've watched, upending it. And I enjoyed it. There are some very manic performances. There are some, I think, both Sean Young and I think that Costner are really hyped up. They're like, say maybe you've had a lot of coffee. And then you've got some people you've got Amon playing the part of the best friend of the murdered Sean Young. And it's also interesting as far as just the cinematography in this, as opposed to something like Target. Target is a very dour looking film. I mean, it's very dark. It's shot during winter time and very, leafless trees and browns and that kind of thing. And this is a very pretty movie. It really has a lot of exteriors, like springtime.
Glamorous.
Oh yeah, and springtime in DC, and shots of Georgetown and running along the river and the greenery. It's a very pretty film, and it's also had a lot, when you watch it, a lot of social subtext about the over the top nature that is Washington DC, and the people wearing the furs and the jewelry and the excess and how out of touch they are. I think there's a beginning part where the band is playing like the Twist or something, or some really out of touch music that in 1985 would have been for really old fogies.
Yeah.
And just, it was a really nice little touch of showing how out of step people are in DC with the rest of America. But it was, it's a beautiful film to look at. And certainly one of those prime examples of 1980s noir.
Yeah. So your wife, was she completely taken in and didn't know that?
She wasn't. She's usually very, she usually catches all these little details, but the twist got her at the end.
Oh, wow. Good.
And I was so glad that I didn't spoil it for her. I was just like, she'd ask me questions and I'm like, I'm not saying a word.
Yeah.
I'm not tell you anything about it. And she'd ask about this certain character. And so the twist really, added something. It was kind of like the Hitchcock thing with Psycho, as far as don't tell anybody the twist,
yes.
Don't even the secret. And I think that's the way No Way Out is. Anyone who'd you'd only have a terrible friend if you're going to see this movie back in 1985 or 86, and a friend is telling you the twist, because that is everything.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. I'm one of those people who, I have no poker face, so I'm the worst. I'm not going to like voluntarily tell you things, but if somebody says something, they can tell by looking at me, like if I'm lying or not. So I would probably be the worst person to sit and watch something like this with, if they just say, well, what about Costner or what? Yeah, I would be a disaster. I wouldn't try to be, but I would fold under questioning, I think, is the point. But we were talking about other movies from this era, and you were bringing up many other examples. We cited a few. Are there any you want to be sure to recommend or just tell people to seek out, just if they're interested in what it was like to be a film goer and also just live in the US in the 80s, what the attitudes were like? Anything you want to recommend?
Well, I think that this was a really, a time where things were really breaking free. I think this spy craze of the 60s just was such an avalanche of pop culture with spies. I think that it was really kind of a cautionary thing of what Hollywood did or did not want to do in the 70s. And so, we get into very untraditional spy films like Marathon Man and movies like that. But I think that the idea of can you trust the Soviets or not? This forbidden society, this secretive life that is it like ours or the Soviets like us? You know, these were questions that I think were in everyone's mind in the mid 80s. But things for me, some of the films did not hold up. Again, like, you know, going back and watching Jumpin' Jack Flash was so much better than I remembered. Target is so much fun. It is a lower budget film. It's not a flashy film. It's a character study. I can see why the actors were drawn to it, because it's a lot about, you know, father-son relationships. One scene I had to mention about Target, which was this crazy kind of Oedipal moment when Matt Dillon puts his mother's underwear on his head. And I thought, this is a little bit of an odd choice. And I wonder what
Martha's like. I've got an idea. A question about birth control too. It was strange.
It was a very odd moment. And I don't know what that was really. We could debate that for a long time. But there were films that I remember being really excellent, like Little Nikita with River Phoenix, and such a, you know, really film kind of like the TV show The Americans before The Americans, about an embedded Soviet family living an average life, and their son finding out that he was part of there's actually, his parents were Soviet agents and coming in. Despite that, River Phoenix is just phenomenal, and Sidney Poitier plays this FBI agent. It's a really awful film. It just was a struggle for me to get. It was just an absolutely terrible script. Awful for me to get through. And then again, I would have films like Jumpin' Jack Flash that I remember them being very over the top and loud and zany. And, you know, and I remembered that. And it's not a spy film, but it is a Soviet film. And really, is Moscow on the Hudson with Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
And I remembered it being very much a Robin Williams vehicle and crazy and this stuff. And I could not have been more wrong. It's a terrific film, and it's like it's an art film. It's beautifully shot. It's like a love letter to New York City. The characters are so grounded, and I guess it's Paul Mazursky, the director, is really reining in considerable high time. You know, Robin Williams, who is wonderful in the part, and they shoot everything on location, and everything has a sense of realism. It's a really, I think it's a great film today because it's so much about immigration, and it's about the experience of immigrants, people coming to America, and about what I had always believed as a kid of America being the great melting pot. It's a love letter to that idea of what is America, but it's so much of a better film than I remembered. I thought it was just fantastic. I'm trying to think of some other films, and they'll probably come to me later.
Brought up Moscow on the Hudson, because I haven't seen that since the early 90s. I remember watching that and like Fisher King and kind of exploring his more melancholy or serious side, and being just blown away by, you know, Awakenings, like this whole different side of Robin Williams. I have great memories of like my dad driving us cross country, and we were listening to the soundtracks of Dirty Dancing and then Good Morning Vietnam before I even understood half the jokes we were hearing of Robin Williams. So that was like my earliest introduction to him. But then when you see like Dead Poets Society, and I went back and rented Moscow on the Hudson, you can see what he can do. And so you're making me excited. I need to go back and watch that. I appreciate you bringing it up.
I think being a kid, teenager in the 80s, we all had this curiosity about the Soviets. And I think what we really wanted at the core, what moviegoers and people wanted, is we wanted them to be just like us. And we wanted them to, we liked the idea that they liked pop culture. We hoped that they watched movies. We hoped that they had the same humanity and that they were not this invisible monster that was set on destroying us. And I think that's what all these films at some point are hopefully trying to get at. And then there was a different age for sure watching these movies. And when we're talking about the post-Vietnam era and coming out of the 70s, an immense distrust of our government, immense distrust. Of course, you're going back to people that are reading about Iran-Contra in the newspaper. You're talking about complete mistrust of the intelligence services. So there's a really kind of wonderful skeptical eye, which is something that I value a lot in my movies. I think that's why my favorite films are probably from the early 30s or 1970s, because of the mistrust of people in power that I think in some ways we've gotten away from. A wonderful check-in to this era and this time and I remember very well.
Well, I'm excited. Your next two books are going to be spy related, spy adjacent. So tell us again, when can we expect the next one? Is it end of June?
End of June. June 25th is a book called Don't Let the Devil Ride, which is very much I would say it has a lot in common with Jumpin' Jack Flash. It is about a woman with an entry point of something goes wrong in her life, her husband goes missing, and then she suddenly is a suburban stay-at-home mom that finds herself involved in international intrigue. And there's certainly characters very much who's, you know, there's certain stock characters that even going back to films like Charade with George Kennedy or the Jim Belushi character from Jumpin' Jack Flash is the unhinged hitman that, you know, and so there's all those kind of little touches that I think have just been hardwired into my brain. But anyway, yes, that book will be out for Morrow, coming out in late June. And again, kind of one of the first chances I've had to really kind of expand upon things that I really love and things that have inspired me so much.
That makes me excited. A few years ago, I discovered, I vaguely remember seeing like reruns as a kid, Scarecrow and Mrs. King.
Remember that TV show? Yes.
Which is great. Yeah.
So many, there were, you know, we could talk about that, you know, even in, you know, I remember there's so much of the Soviet paranoia, even like on Magnum PI.
Yeah.
You know, there's a character, I think his name was Ivan, who was the bad KGB who had tortured Thomas Magnum going back in Vietnam. And, it was in the ether. It was all around us. It was the idea of the Soviet Union was very big in our lives during that time.
Yes. Well, Ace, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It was a joy to revisit these movies and finally to meet you. You're going to have to come up with another topic and come talk movies again.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it so much, Jen.
Thank you.
Take care.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the Free Music Archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.